game of chance as though she were an animal from the flock or a stranger among us, and not the mother of his sons. I ask you to treat her better than her own husband. I ask you to act as the father." Jacob frowned at his wife's request, although in his heart he must have been pleased that she addressed him not only as her husband, but as leader of her family as well. He stood above Leah, whose head was bowed, and looked down on her tenderly. "Wife," he said, and took her hands to raise her up. "Leah." Their eyes met, and she smiled. I was shocked. I had come to watch Rudy's story unfold, but I discovered something else altogether. I saw the heat between my mother and her husband. I saw that Jacob could cause the glow of assent and happiness that I thought only I could summon from Leah. My eyes opened for the first time upon the fact that my father was a man. I saw that he was not only tall, but also broad-shouldered and narrow in the waist. Although by then he must have passed his 40th summer, his back was straight, and he still had most of his teeth and a clear eye. My father was handsome, I realized. My father was worthy of my mother. Yet I found no consolation in this discovery. As they moved back to the tents, Leah and Jacob walked side by side, their heads nearly touching, as she whispered the ransom that Jacob could collect from among his wives to redeem Rudy. Honey and herbs, a stack of copper bangles, a bolt of linen, and three of wool. He listened silently, nodding from time to time. There was no room for me between them, no need for me. My mother's eyes were full of Jacob. I did not matter to her the way she mattered to me. I wanted to cry, but I realized that I was too old for that. I would be a woman soon, and I would have to learn how to live with a divided heart. Miserable, I followed as my parents entered the circle of tents. Leah fell silent and resumed her place behind her husband. She fetched a jug of her strongest beer to help Jacob soften the traitor's resolve. But the man had seen that though she was worn out and homely, Laban's woman was neither hair-lipped nor lame, as her price had led him to believe, and he was shrewd enough to notice that his presence had caused a stir. He smelled his advantage, which meant it took all of the women's treasures and one of Jacob's pups before the traitor forgave the debt and left without Rudy. Soon, all the women of the camp knew what had happened, and for weeks afterward, Jacob ate like a prince. Laban never spoke of how Jacob ransomed his wife. He only became fouler in his use of Rudy, whose eyes seemed permanently blackened after that. Her sons, following their father's pattern, showed their mother no respect. They carried no water for her cooking pot and brought her no game from their hunts. She crept around her men in silent service. Among the women, Rudy spoke only of my mother's kindness. She became Leah's shadow, kissing her hands and her hem, sitting as close to her savior as she could. The ragged woman's presence did not please Leah, who occasionally lost patience with her. "Go to your tent," she said when Rudy got underfoot. But Leah always regretted rebuking Rudy, who cringed at a single cross word from my mother. After she sent her away, Leah sought her out and sat down beside the poor, wasted soul and let herself be kissed and thanked again and again. Chapter 2. In the days following Rudy's redemption, Jacob began to plan our departure in earnest. During his nights with Leah and during his nights with Rachel, he spoke of his longing to leave Laban's tents and return to the land of his father. Jacob told Bilhah that his restlessness consumed his peace and that he slept badly. Jacob found Zilpah on a night when sleeplessness chased them both, separately, to the whispering comfort of the great terebinth that stood by the altar. Even on still, airless nights, breezes hid among the broad, flat leaves of Zilpah's tree. Jacob told his fourth wife that his God had appeared to him and said that it was time to leave the land of the two rivers. It was time to take his wives and his sons and the wealth that he had built up with his hands. Jacob told Zilpah that his dreams had become ferocious. Night after night, fiery voices called him back to Canaan, to the land of his father. Fierce as his dreams were, they were joyful too. Rebekah shone like the sun, and Isaac smiled a blessing. Even his brother no longer threatened, but appeared as a huge ruddy bull that welcomed Jacob to ride upon his wide back. And it seemed Jacob had no need to fear his brother anymore, for traders from Canaan had brought news that Esau had become a prosperous herdsman, with many sons of his own, and a reputation for generosity. In their day alone in the red tent, Jacob's wives spoke among themselves about their husband's dreams and plans. Rachel's eyes shone at the prospect of moving to the south. She was the most traveled among them, having attended at births throughout the hills, to Carchemish and once to the city of Haran itself. "Oh, to see great mountains and a real city," she said. "Marketplaces filled with fine goods and fruits whose names we do not even know. We will meet faces from the four corners. We will hear the music of silver timbrels and golden flutes." Leah was not so eager to discover the new worlds beyond the valley that had given her life. "I am content with the faces I see around me here," she said. "But I would dearly love to be free of Laban's stench. We will go, of course, but I will leave with regret." Bilhah nodded. "I will grieve to leave Ada's bones. I will miss seeing the sun rise on the place where I gave birth to my son. I will mourn the passing of our youth. But I am ready, and our sons are wild to be gone from here." Bilhah gave voice to a truth that had gone unspoken. There was not enough room for so many sons to make their way in Haran, where every hillock had been claimed for many generations. There was no land in the country of their mothers. If the family did not leave together, the women would soon break their hearts watching as their sons turned against each other or disappeared in search of their own paths. Zilpah's breath grew louder and more uneven as her sisters turned their faces to the future. "I cannot go," she burst out. "I cannot leave the holy tree, which is the source of my power, or the bama, which is soaked in my offerings. How will the gods know where I am if I am not here to serve them? Who will protect me? Sisters, we will be beset by demons." She was wide-eyed. "This tree, this place, this is where she is, my little goddess, Nanshi." The sisters sat up to hear Zilpah speak the name of her own deity, something done only on a deathbed. Their sister felt herself at the end of hope, and her voice was choked with tears as she said, "You too, sisters, all of your named gods abide here. This is the place where we are known, where we know how to serve. It will be death to leave. I know it." There was silence as the others stared. Bilhah spoke first. "Every place has its holy names, its trees and high places," she said, in the calm voice a mother takes to a frightened child. "There will be gods where we go." But Zilpah would not meet Bilhah's eyes and only shook her head from side to side. "No," she whispered. Leah spoke next. "Zilpah, we are your protection. Your family, your sisters, are the only surety against hunger, against cold, against madness. Sometimes, I wonder if the gods are dreams and stories to while away cold nights and dark thoughts." Leah grabbed her sister by the shoulders. "Better to put your trust in my hands and Jacob's than in stories made out of wind and fear." Zilpah shrank under her sister's hands and turned away. "No," she said. Rachel listened to Leah's sensible blasphemy in wonder and spoke, picking words for thoughts she discovered only as she gave them voice. "We can never answer your fear with proof, Zilpah. The gods are always silent. I know that women in travail find strength and comfort in the names of their gods. I have seen them struggle beyond all hope at the sound of an incantation. I have seen life spared at the last moment, for no other reason than that hope. But I know, too, that gods do not protect even the kindest, most pious women from heartbreak or death. So Bilhah is right. We will take Nanshi with us, she said, naming Zilpah's beloved goddess of dreams and singers. We will take Gula, too, naming the goddess of healing to whom Rachel made offerings. And then, as the idea grew in her mind, Rachel blurted, We will take all of the teraphim from our tents and carry them into Canaan with our husband and our children. They will do us no harm, surely, said Rachel, speaking faster and faster as the plan formed in her mind. If they are in our keeping, they will do Laban no good, she added slyly. Bilhah and Leah laughed nervously at the idea of Laban stripped of his sacred figures. The old man consulted the statues when he had any choice to make, stroking his favorites absent-mindedly for hours at a time. Leah said they soothed him the way a full breast soothed a cranky baby. To leave with the teraphim was to incite Laban's wrath. Even so, Rachel had some claim to them. In the old days, when the family had lived in the city of Ur, it was the unquestioned right of the youngest daughter to inherit all the holy things. Those ways were no longer held in universal respect, and Kemuel could claim the teraphim as part of an older son's birthright with just as much authority. The sisters sat in silence, considering Rachel's bold idea. Finally, Rachel spoke. I will take the teraphim, and they will be a source of power for us. They will be a sign of our birthright. Our father will suffer as he has made others suffer. I will not speak of this again. Zilpah wiped her eyes. Leah cleared her throat. Bilhah stood up. It had been decided. I barely took a breath. I was afraid that if they remembered me, I would be sent out of the tent. I sat still between my mother's right hand and Bilhah's left hand, amazed at what I had heard. Rachel was loyal to Gula the healer. Bilhah's grain offerings were made to Utu the weaver. Leah had a special feeling for Ninkazi, the brewer of beer, who used a brewing vat made of clear lapis lazuli and a ladle made of silver and gold. I thought of the gods and goddesses as aunts and uncles who were bigger than my parents, and able to live inside the ground or above the earth as they liked. I imagined them deathless, odorless, forever happy, strong, and interested in everything that happened to me. I was frightened to hear Leah, the wisest of women, wondering if these powerful friends might be nothing but stories told to calm the nightmares of children. I shuddered. My mother put her hand on my cheek to feel for fever, but I was cool to her touch. Later that night, I awoke screaming and sweating in a terror of falling, but she came to me and lay down beside me, and the warmth of her body comforted me. Secure in the knowledge of her love, I began to cross over into sleep. Then I roused for a moment, thinking I heard Rachel's voice saying, Remember this moment, when your mother's body heals every trouble of your soul. I looked around, but my auntie was nowhere nearby. It must have been a dream. 3 days later, Leah walked to the rocky pasture in the west to tell Jacob that his wives were ready to go with him to the land of his birth. I followed after her, carrying some bread and beer for my father. I was not entirely pleased at being pressed into service on such a warm day. As I came over the rise that separated our camp from the grazing, I was stopped by a scene of perfect wonder. Many of the ewes were heavy with lambs and barely moved in the gathering heat. The rising sun summoned the clover's scent. Only the bees made a sound under the brazen blue banner of sky. I stopped as my mother walked ahead. The world seemed so perfect, so complete, and yet so impermanent that I nearly wept. I would have to tell Zilpah about this feeling and ask if she knew a song for it. But then I realized that something in the universe had shifted. Something important had changed. I searched the horizon. The sky was still clear, the clover still pungent, the bees buzzed. I noticed that my mother and my father were not alone. Leah stood facing her husband. By her side was Rachel. The two women had made a kind of peace years earlier. They did not work together or consult with each other. They did not sit next to each other in the red tent or address each other directly, and they were never in their husband's presence at the same time. Yet now the three stood in plain sight, talking like old friends. The women had their backs to me. The conversation ended as I approached. My mother and aunt turned away from Jacob, and upon seeing me, replaced their solemn expressions with the false smiles that adults show children from whom they wish to hide something. I did not return their smiles. I knew they had been talking of leaving. I placed my father's food and drink at his feet and had turned to follow Leah and Rachel back to the tents when Jacob, my father, spoke. "Dina," he said. It was the first time I remember hearing my name in his mouth. "Thank you, girl. May you always be a comfort to your mothers." I looked into his face, and he smiled a real smile at me. But I did not know how to smile at my father or answer him, so I turned to run after my mother and Rachel, who had already begun the walk back to the tents. I slipped my hand into Leah's and peeked back to look at Jacob once more. But he had already turned away from me. Jacob began to negotiate for our departure that evening. As night fell, and for many nights afterward, the women lay down on their beds with the sounds of men's voices loud in their ears. Laban was perfectly willing to see Jacob gone with his daughters and the grandsons who ate too much and respected him too little. But the old man hated to think that Jacob might leave a rich man. During the long nights of shouting, Laban sat between his sons, Kemuel and Beor. The three of them drank beer and wine and yawned into Jacob's face and ended their conversations before anything could be settled. Jacob sat between his oldest sons, Reuben and Simon, and touched no drink stronger than barley beer. Behind him stood Levi and Judah. The seven younger boys stood outside the tent, straining to hear what was said. Joseph told me what he overheard, and I repeated everything to my mothers. But I did not tell Joseph about the whispered conversations among the women. I did not report their hoarding of hard bread or how they had taken to sewing herbs into the hems of their garments. I knew better than to breathe of Rachel's plan to carry off the teraphim. Night after night, Laban argued that he owed Jacob nothing more than the meager dowries he'd bestowed upon Leah and Rachel, which would have left my father without so much as the tents over our heads. Then, in a great show of generosity, he offered 20 head of sheep and 20 goats, one of each kind for every year of Jacob's service, which had enriched Laban beyond his dreams. Jacob, for his part, claimed the right of any overseer, which would have given him a tenth of the herds and the pick of them too. He demanded his wife's personal property, which amounted to a good pile of grindstones and spindles, looms and jugs, jewelry and cheeses. He reminded Laban that his tents, his flocks, and the bondsmen in his debt had come to him through the work of Jacob's hands. He threatened to seek justice from the tribunal at Haran, but that only made Laban sneer. He had gambled and drunk deeply with the town fathers for many years and had no doubt whose side they would take. Late one night, after weeks of fruitless talk, Jacob found the words that moved Laban's heart. The husband of Leah and Rachel, the father of the sons of Zilpah and Bilhah, fixed Laban with his eye and threatened that the God of his fathers would not look kindly on one who swindled the anointed of his tribe. Jacob said that his God had come to him in a dream and spoken to him and told him to go with his wives and his sons and his flocks in abundance. Jacob's God had said that anyone who tried to thwart him would suffer in his body, in his flocks, and in his sons. This troubled the old man, who shivered before the power of any god. When Jacob invoked the God of his fathers, the smirk dropped from Laban's lips. Jacob's success with the flocks, the health of his 11 sons, the loyalty of the bondsmen to him, and even the prowess of his dogs, all this signaled that Jacob was blessed by heaven. Laban remembered all the years of excellent sacrifice that Jacob had made to his God, and the old man reckoned that El must be well pleased by so much devotion. The next day, Laban shut himself up with his household gods and was not seen until evening, when he called for Jacob. From the moment Jacob faced his father-in-law, he could see that the advantage had shifted. He began to bargain in earnest. "My father," he said, false honey on his tongue, "because you have been good to me, I wish to take only the animals that are brindled and spotted, the ones whose wool and hides will bring me less at market. You will maintain the pure bloods of the herds. I will go out from your house poor, but grateful." Laban sensed a trick in Jacob's offer, but he couldn't divine the benefit. Everyone knew that the darker animals did not produce wool that spun white or skins that tanned evenly. What Laban did not know was that the poorer beasts were hardier and healthier than the animals that yielded the fancy wool and the pretty skins. The brindled ewes dropped twins more often than not, and most of their offspring were females, which meant more cheese. The hair of his mottled goats was especially oily, which made for a stronger rope. But these were Jacob's secrets, which he had learned during his years with the herds. This was knowledge that Laban's laziness had cost him. Laban said, "So be it." And the men drank wine to seal the agreement. Jacob would go with his wives and his sons, and with the brindled and spotted flocks, which numbered no more than 60 goats and 60 sheep. There would have been more livestock, but Jacob traded for two of the bondsmen and their women. In exchange for a donkey and an ancient ox, Jacob agreed to leave two of his dogs, including the best of the herders. All of the household goods of Leah and Rachel were Jacob's to take, as well as the clothing and jewelry worn by Zilpah and Bilhah. Jacob claimed his sons' cloaks and spears, 2 looms and 24 minas of wool, 6 baskets of grain, 12 jugs of oil, 10 skins of wine, and water skins, 1 for each person. But that was only the official reckoning, which did not take into account my mother's cleverness. They decided upon a date for our departure in 3 months' time. While that seemed an eternity when it was first announced, the weeks passed quickly. My mother set about collecting, discarding, packing, sorting, trading, washing. They devised sandals for the journey and baked loaves of hard bread. They hid their best jewelry deep inside the grain baskets in case thieves accosted us on the road. They scoured the hills for herbs to fill up their pouches. Had they chosen to, my mothers could have stripped the garden bare. They could have taken every onion bulb, dug up every buried store of grain, and emptied every beehive within walking distance. But they took only what they considered rightly theirs, and nothing more. They did this not out of respect for Laban, but for the bondswomen and their children who would be left behind. Sent to fetch and carry, I worked hard too. No one petted me or fussed over my hair. No one smiled into my face or praised my spinning. I felt misused and ignored, but no one noticed when I brooded. So I stopped feeling sorry for myself and did as I was told. It might have been a joyous time had it not been for Ruti, who in the last weeks of our preparations lost all heart. She took to sitting in the dust before Leah's tent, a graven image of despair, forcing everyone to step around her. Leah crouched down and tried to persuade Ruti to move, to come inside her tent and eat something, to take comfort. But Ruti was past comfort. Leah suffered for the poor woman, who was no older than she, yet whose teeth were gone and who shuffled like a crone. But there was nothing to be done, and after several attempts at coaxing her out of her misery, my mother stood up and moved on. On the night before the last new moon we spent in the land of the two rivers, the wives of Jacob gathered quietly in the red tent. The sisters sat, letting the 3-cornered cake sit untouched in the basket before them. Bilhah said, "Ruti will die now." Her words hung in the air, unchallenged and true. One day, Laban will hit her too hard, or she will simply waste away from sorrow. Zilpah sighed into the silence, and Leah wiped her eyes. Rachel stared at her hands. My mother pulled me onto her lap, a place that I had outgrown, but I sat there and let her baby me, and enjoyed her thoughtless caresses. The women burned a portion of their lunar cake in offering, as they did for every new moon, as they did every seventh day. But they sang no songs of thanksgiving, nor did they dance. The next day, the bondswomen joined Jacob's wives for the moon days. But it was more like a funeral than a feast. No one asked the pregnant woman to recount her symptoms. No one spoke of the exploits of her son. The women did not braid one another's hair or rub one another's feet with oil. The sweet cakes went untouched, except by babies who wandered in and out, seeking their mother's breasts and laps. Of all the bondswomen, only Zebatu and Uzna would be going to Canaan with my mother's. The others would stay behind with their husbands. It was the end of a long sisterhood. They had held one another's legs in childbirth and suckled one another's babies. They had laughed in the garden and sung harmonies for the new moon. But those days were ending, and each woman sat with her own memories, her own loss. For the first time, the red tent became a sad place, and I sat outside until I was tired enough to sleep. Ruti did not appear in the tent. Morning came and evening, and still she did not come. As the sun rose on the second day, my mother sent me to look for her. I asked Joseph if our grandfather's wife had made bread that morning. I asked Judah if Ruti was anywhere to be found. I asked my brothers and the daughters of the bondswomen, but no one could remember seeing Ruti. No one could recall. By then, misery had made her nearly invisible. I went to the top of the hill where I had been so happy a few months ago, but now the sky was dull and the land appeared gray. I scanned the horizon and saw no one. I walked to the well, but I was alone. I climbed the low branches of a tree at the far edge of the near pasture, but I did not see Ruti. On the way back to tell my mother that she was nowhere to be found, I came upon her. She was lying in the side of a dry wadi, a desolate place where stray lambs sometimes wandered and broke their legs. At first, I thought Ruti was asleep on her back, lying against the steep slope. As I walked closer, I could see that her eyes were open. So I called out to her, but she made no move to answer me. That was when I saw that her mouth was slack and that there were flies at the corners of her eyes and on her wrist, which was black with blood. Carrion birds circled above. I had never seen a corpse before. My eyes filled with Ruti's face, which was no longer Ruti's face, but a piece of blue slate bearing traces of a face I remembered. She did not look sad. She did not look pained. She looked nothing but empty. I stared, trying to understand where Ruti had gone, and although I didn't realize it, I was holding my breath. I might never have moved from that spot had Joseph not appeared behind me. Rachel had sent him out looking for Ruti, too. He walked past me and crouched down beside the body. He blew gently into her fixed eyes, touched her cheek with his finger, and then placed his right hand upon her eyes to close them. I was amazed at my brother's courage and calm. But then, Joseph shuddered and jumped back as though he'd been bitten by a snake. He ran to the bottom of the wadi, down to where water had once flowed and where flowers must have blossomed. Falling to his knees, Joseph retched into the dry bed. With great sobs, he knelt and heaved and coughed. When I walked over to him, he lurched to his feet and motioned me to keep away. "Go back and tell them," I whispered. "I'll stay here and keep the vultures away." I regretted my words the moment they were out of my mouth. Joseph didn't bother to answer, but bolted as though a wolf were pursuing him. I turned away from the body, but I could not shut out the sound of the flies at her wrist and the bloody knife that lay by her side. The vultures flapped and squawked. The wind cut through my tunic, and I shivered. I walked to the top of the wadi and tried to think kind thoughts about Rudy. But all I could remember was the fear in her eyes, the dirt in her hair, the sour smell of her body, the defeated crouch. She had been a woman just as my mother was a woman, and yet she was a creature totally unlike my mother. I did not understand Leia's kindness to Rudy. In my heart, I shared her son's disdain for her. Why did she submit to Laban? Why did she not demand her son's respect? How could she find the courage to kill herself when she had no courage for life? I was ashamed of my heart's coldness, for I knew that Bilha would have cried to see Rudy lying here, and that Leia would pour ashes on her own hair when she learned what had happened. But the longer I stood there, the more I hated Rudy for her weakness and for making me keep watch. It seemed no one would come for me, and I began to tremble. Perhaps Rudy would rise up and take her knife to me as punishment for my cruel thoughts. Perhaps the gods of the underworld would come for her and take me as well. I started to weep for my mother to come and rescue me. I called the name of each aunt. I called Joseph and Reuben and Judah, but it seemed they had forgotten me. By the time I saw the shape of two people moving across the meadow, I was sick with worry, but there was no one to comfort me. The women had remained in the tent. Only Rudy's horrible sons had come. They threw a blanket over their mother's face without so much as a sigh. Beor threw the little bundle that was Rudy over his shoulders, as if he were carrying a stray kid. I followed him alone. Camuel paid no attention to his poor dead mother and hunted a rabbit on the way back. "Ha ha!" he shouted when his arrow found its mark. Only when I saw the red tent on the edge of the camp did the tears begin to run down my cheeks again, and I ran to my mother's. Leia searched my face and covered it with kisses. Rachel hugged me close and laid me down on her fragrant bed. Zilpah sang me a lullaby about abundant rains and luxuriant harvests, while Bilha rubbed my feet until I fell asleep. I did not wake up until the next evening, and by then Rudy was under the ground. We left a few days later. My father and older brothers, all the bondsmen, and Laban's sons went off to the far pastures to separate the brindled and spotted livestock that now belonged to Jacob. Of all the men, only Laban remained in camp, counting up jugs as they were filled, making messes of neatly piled woolens to check that we took nothing he had not agreed to. "It is my right," he barked without apology. Eventually, Laban grew tired of spying on his daughter's labors and decided to go to Haran on business. Leia sneered at the announcement. "The old man is going to gamble and drink and boast to the other lazy clods that he is finally rid of his greedy son-in-law and his ungrateful daughters," she told me as we cooked a meal for him to take on his journey. Beor accompanied Laban, who made a great show of leaving Kemuel in command. "He has my authority in all things," said Laban to the wives and younger sons of Jacob, whom he assembled for his departure. No sooner had Laban disappeared over the hill than Kemuel demanded that Rachel herself bring him strong wine. "Send me no ugly serving girls," he bellowed. "I want my sister." Rachel made no objection to serving him, as it gave her the opportunity to pour an herb that hastens sleep into his cup. "Drink well, brother," she said sweetly as he swallowed the first cup. "Have another." He was snoring within an hour of Laban's departure. Every time he roused, Rachel went to his tent with her brew and sat with him, feigning interest in his crude attempts at seduction, and filling his cup so full and so often that he lost the whole day, and the next one, too. While Kemuel snored, the men returned, bringing the flocks into the near pasture just over the rise from the tents. So the final hours of our preparation were filled with bleating, dust, and animal smells. They were filled, too, with the unaccustomed noise and tension of so many men in our midst. On ordinary days, the tents were populated only by women and children. A sick or feeble man might lie on his bed or sit in the sun while the work of wool and bread and beer progressed about him, but such a man knew enough to be embarrassed and kept to himself. We had a whole crowd of healthy men with little to do. "What a nuisance," said my mother, of the relentless presence of her sons. "They're always hungry," grumbled Bila, who never grumbled. After sending Reuben away for the second time that morning with a bowl of lentils and onions, every few minutes Bila or Leah had to stop what they were doing to heat the breadstones. The presence of the men presented a more subtle difficulty as well. The tents were Leah's domain, and although she was the one who knew what needed to be done, she would not give orders with her husband by her side. So she stood behind Jacob and softly asked, "Is my husband ready to dismantle the big loom and lay it into the cart?" And he would direct his sons to do what was needed. And so it went, until everything was ready. Throughout the weeks of preparation, and especially after Laban departed for Haran, I kept close to my Aunt Rachel. I found reasons to follow her from one task to the next, offering to carry for her, asking her for advice on my duties. I stayed by her side until nightfall, even falling asleep upon her blankets, and woke in the morning to find myself covered by her sweet-scented cloak. I tried to be careful, but she knew that I was watching her. On the night before we left, Rachel caught my eye, which was fixed upon her every move. At first, she glared, but then she stared back in a way that told me I had triumphed. I could follow her. We went to the Bama, where Zilpah was lying face down beside the altar, whispering to the gods and goddesses we were about to abandon. She looked up as we sat down among the roots of the great tree there, but I'm not even sure that Zilpah saw me sitting between Rachel's knees. As we waited, my aunt braided my hair and told me about the healing properties of common herbs. Coriander seeds for bellyache, cumin for wounds. She had long ago decided that I should learn what Inna had taught her. We stayed there in the lap of the tree until Zilpah rose, sighed, and left. We sat until the sounds from the tents quieted and the last lamps were extinguished. We stayed until the moon, halfway to fullness, was high in the branches above us, and the only sound was the occasional bleating of a sheep. Then Rachel rose, and I followed as she walked softly to Laban's tent. My aunt made no acknowledgement of my presence, and I was not sure she knew I was behind her until she held the tent flap open for me, to a place I had never been, nor wished to go. It was dark as a dry well in my grandfather's tent, and the air was fetid and stale. Rachel, who had been here to ply Kemuel with drink, walked past his snoring body directly to the corner of the tent where a rough wooden bench served as Laban's altar. The teraphim were arrayed in two rows. Rachel reached out for them without hesitation and dropped them one by one into the cloth tied around her waist, as though she were harvesting onions. When the last of the idols fell into her apron, she turned, walked across the tent without a glance at Kemuel, who moaned in his sleep as she passed him, and soundlessly held the tent flap open for me. We walked out into stillness. My heart pounded in my ears, and I drew a breath to rid myself of the tent stink. But Rachel did not pause. She walked quickly to her tent, where Bilha slept. I heard my aunt rustling among the blankets, but it was too dark to see where she hid the idols. Then Rachel lay down, and I heard nothing more. I wanted to shake her and demand that she show me the treasures. I wanted her to hug me and tell me how well I had done in keeping still. But I remained quiet. I laid down to the pounding of my heart, thinking that Kemuel would rush into the tent and kill us all. I wondered if the teraphim would come to life and cast terrible spells on us for disturbing them. I was sure that morning would never come, and I shivered into my blanket, though the night was not cold. Finally, my eyes closed to a dreamless sleep. I awoke to a great noise of voices outside the tent. Rachel and Bilhah were already gone, and I was alone with two piles of neatly folded blankets. She had taken them with her, I realized. Rachel had moved the idols without me. After all my careful watching and following, I had missed it. I rushed outside to see my brothers rolling up the goatskins that had been my father's tent. All around me, tents were on the ground, the poles collected, ropes coiled. My home had been dismantled. We were going. Jacob had risen at dawn and made a sacrifice of grain and wine and oil for the journey. The herds, sensing a change, were bleating and kicking up dust. The dogs would not stop barking. Half of the tents were down, leaving the camp looking lopsided and desolate, as though a great wind had blown away half the world. We ate a morning meal salted by the tears of those who would not accompany us. The women put away the last of the bowls and stood with empty hands. There was nothing left for us to do, but Jacob gave no sign for us to leave. Laban had not returned from Haran as he had promised. The sun began to rise higher, and we should have been long gone. But Jacob stood alone at the top of the ridge that faced the road to Haran, squinting for a sign of Laban. Jacob's sons muttered among themselves. Zilpah walked to the Bama, where she ripped her tunic and placed ashes on her hair. It grew hot and still, and even the herds quieted down. Then Rachel walked past Reuben and Simon, Levi and Judah, who stood at the bottom of the hill where Jacob watched, and she approached her husband and said, "Let us go. Kemuel told me his father will return with spears and riders and prevent us from leaving. He has gone to tell the judges in Haran that you are a thief. We must not wait." Jacob listened and then replied, "Your father fears my God too much to act so boldly, and Kemuel is a fool." Rachel bowed her head and said, "My husband may know better, but the herds are ready and the goods are packed. Our feet are shod, and we stand with nothing to do. We do not steal away in the dark of night. We take nothing but what is our own. The season is right. If we wait much longer, the moon will begin to wane, and a darkening moon is no time to embark upon a journey." Rachel spoke nothing but the truth, and Jacob had no wish to see Laban again. Indeed, he was furious with the old man for making him wait, for making him leave like a thief, without giving proper farewell to the grandfather of his sons. Rachel's words spoke to Jacob's own purpose, and after she left him, he gave the order to go. Impatient to be underway, the sons of Jacob shouted with happiness, but a wail went up from the women who were staying behind. My father signaled us to follow him. He led us first to the Bama, where each of us placed a pebble by the altar. The men picked up any small rock that lay at their feet to leave in farewell. Leah and Rachel sought out stones from around the foot of the nearby terebinth, which had given them years of shade and comfort. No words were spoken. The stones would testify for us, though Bilhah kissed hers before laying it on top of the others. Zilpah and I alone were prepared for this moment. Weeks earlier, my grieving aunt had taken me to the wadi where Ruti had died, and showed me a place at the bottom of the ravine filled with smooth, oval-shaped stones. She chose a tiny white one, the size of her thumbnail. I took a red one, streaked with black, nearly as big as my fist. She kept it for me and placed it in my palm as we walked for the last time to the holy place of my family. Then Jacob led his family over the hill to where the bondsmen waited with the herd. My mothers did not look back. Not even Zilpah, whose eyes were red, but dry. Chapter 3. My father arranged his family, his flocks, and all of his household for the journey. Jacob led, holding a great olive staff in his hand, flanked by Levi and Simon, who strutted with importance. Behind them walked the women and children too young to be tending the herds, so Uzna's little son and daughter stayed near their mother's legs, and Zibatu carried her baby girl in a hip sling. I started out near Zilpah, hoping to lighten the sadness that clung to her. But her sorrow finally chased me to my mother and Bilha, who were engrossed in planning meals and paid no attention to me. So I found my way to Rachel, whose smile did not fade even as the sun began to beat down on us in earnest. The bundle on her back was more than large enough for the teraphim, and I was sure that was where they were hidden. Joseph, Tali, and Issa were told to stay with the pack animals near the women, which made them sulk and kick at the dirt and mutter about how they were old enough to be trusted with more important work than tending a tame donkey and the ox who drew the heavy cart. Directly behind us and the beasts of burden, Reuben had charge of the herd and the shepherds, who included Zebulun and Dan, Gad and Asher, and the bondsmen Nomir, husband of Zebatu, and Zimri, father of Uzna's children. The four dogs ran around the perimeter of the flocks, their ears flattened to their heads as they worked. They lifted their brown eyes from the goats and sheep only when Jacob approached, and bounded to their master's side to bask for a moment in the touch of his hand and the sound of his voice. Judah, our rear guard, walked behind the herds, watching out for stragglers. I would have been lonely there with no one to talk to, but my brother seemed to enjoy his solitude. I was in awe of our numbers and what seemed our great wealth. Joseph told me that we were a small party by any measure, with only two pack animals to carry our belongings, but I remained proud of my father's holdings, and I thought my mother carried herself like a queen. We had walked for only a little while when Levi pointed out a figure ahead, sitting by the side of the path. As we came closer, Rachel shouted, "Inna!" and ran ahead to greet her friend and teacher. The midwife was arrayed for travel, a donkey laden with blankets and baskets by her side. The caravan did not stop at the unexpected sight of the lone woman. It would have been pointless to bring the herd to a halt in the absence of water. Instead, Inna approached Jacob, leading her donkey and falling in a step behind him. Inna did not address my father, but spoke to Rachel so that he would overhear her words. The midwife presented her case with fancy phrases that sounded odd coming from a mouth that usually spoke in the plainest and sometimes the coarsest of terms. "Oh, my friend," she said, "I cannot bear to see you part. My life would be desolate in your absence, and I am too old to take another apprentice. I wish only to join with your family and be among you for the rest of my days. I would give your husband all my possessions in exchange for his protection and a place among the women of his tents. I would accompany you as your bondswoman or as your maidservant to practice my craft in the south and learn what they have to teach there. I would minister to your family, setting the bricks for your women, healing the wounds of your men, offering service to Gula, the healer, in Jacob's name," Inna said. She flattered my father, whom she called wise as well as kind. She declared herself his servant. I was one of many witnesses to Inna's speech. Levi and Simon stayed close, curious to learn what the midwife wanted. Leah and Bilha had quickened their pace to discover why their friend had appeared among them. Even Zilpah roused herself and drew near. Rachel turned her face to Jacob, her eyebrows posing the question, her hands clasped at her chest. Her husband smiled into her face. "Your friend is welcome. She will be your maidservant in my eyes. She is yours as though she were part of your dowry. There is nothing more to say." Rachel kissed Jacob's hand and placed it for a moment upon her heart. Then she led Inna and her donkey back to our animals, where the women could talk more freely. "Sister," Rachel said to the midwife, "what is this about?" Inna dropped her voice and began by telling a sorry tale about a deformed stillbirth, a tiny head, twisted limbs, born to a girl made pregnant at her first blood. "Too young," said Inna with an angry mouth, "far too young." The father was a stranger, a wild-haired man of many years who wore only a loincloth and brought his wife to Inna's hut. When the baby and mother both died, He accused the midwife of causing his misfortune by casting spells upon them. Inna, who had spent 3 terrible days working to save the mother, could not hold her tongue. Exhausted and sorrowful, she called the man a monster and accused him of being the girl's father as well as her husband. Then she spit in his face. Enraged, the stranger reached for her throat and would have killed her had it not been for neighbors who were drawn by her screams and pulled him away. Inna showed us the black bruises on her throat. The man demanded restitution from Inna's father, but Inna had no father, nor had she brother or husband. She had lived alone after her mother's death. Having kept her family's hut, she did not want for shelter, and midwifery kept her in grain and oil and even wool for trade. Since she was a burden to no one, none had troubled about her. But now, the angry stranger demanded to know why the townspeople tolerated such an abomination. "A woman alone is a danger," he screamed into the faces of Inna's neighbors. "Where are your judges?" he hissed. "Who are your elders?" At that, Inna grew frightened. The most powerful man of her mud village had hated her since she had turned down a marriage offer on behalf of his half-wit son. She feared that he would incite the men against her, and perhaps even enslave her. "Idiots, all of them," she said, and spat into the dust. "My thoughts turn to you for refuge," she said, addressing all the women of my family, who walked nearby, listening to her every word. "Rachel knows I have always wanted to see more of the world than these dusty hills, and since Jacob treats his wives better than most, I came to see your departure as a gift from the gods," she continued. "And sisters, I must tell you, I am tired of eating my evening meal alone. I wish to see a baby I delivered as he grows into manhood. I wish to celebrate the new moon among friends. I want to know that my bones will be planted well after my death." Looking around at us, she smiled broadly. "So here I am." The women smiled back at her, happy to have such a healer among them. Although Rachel was skilled, Inna was famous for her golden hands and beloved for her stories. Zilpah saw Inna's appearance as a good omen. The midwife's presence lifted her spirits so much that later my aunt began to sing. It was nothing exalted, only a children's song about a fly who bothered a rabbit who ate the insect but was eaten by a dog, who was in turn eaten by a jackal, who was hunted by a lion, who was killed by a boastful man, who was snatched by An and Enlil, the sky gods, and placed in the heavens to teach him a lesson. It was a simple song known to every child, and thus to every adult who had been a child. By the last verse, all of my mothers and the bondswomen and their children were singing. Even my brothers had joined in, with Simon and Levi making a contest of it, out-shouting each other. When the song ended, everyone clapped hands and laughed. It was sweet to be free of Laban's shadow. It was sweet to be at the beginning of a new life. That was the first time I heard women's voices and men's voices raised in song together, and throughout the journey, the boundaries between the men's lives and the women's relaxed. We joined the men in the work of watering the herd. They helped us unpack for the evening meal. We listened to them sing herding songs, addressed to the night sky and filled with tales of the constellations. They heard our spinning songs, which we sang as we walked and worked wool with small spindles. We applauded one another and laughed together. It was time out of life. It was like a dream. Most of the singing took place just before sleep, or early in the morning while we were still fresh. By afternoon, everyone was hungry and footsore. It took the women several days to get accustomed to wearing sandals from sunup to sunset. At home, we stayed barefoot in and around the tents. Inna relieved our blisters and soothed our aches by massaging our feet with oil perfumed with thyme. There was nothing wrong with our appetites, though. The long days left everyone ferociously hungry, and it was good that my brothers could supplement the simple bread and porridge of the road with birds and hares they hunted along the way. The meat tasted strange, but wonderful, the way Inna prepared it. with a bright yellow spice she got in trade. There was little conversation during the evening meal. The men were in their circle, the women among themselves. By the time the moon rose, everyone was asleep. The women and babies crowded inside one large tent, the men and boys on blankets under the stars. At dawn, after a hurried meal of cold bread, olives, and cheese, we began again. After a few days of this, I could barely remember my old life, rooted in one place. Every morning brought a new wonder. The first day, Inna joined us. The second day, late in the afternoon, we came upon a great river. My father had said we would cross the great water, but I had given no thought to the meaning of his words. When we came to the top of a hill overlooking the river valley, I was amazed. I had never seen so much water in one place, nor had any of us except Jacob and Inna. The river was not very wide where we forded it, or him, as Zilpah would have me say. Even so, it was 20 times wider than the streams I had known. He lay across the valley like a sparkling path, the setting sun catching fire on the way. We came to a crossing where the bottom was packed with pebbles and the ford was wide. The ground on either bank had been beaten smooth by many caravans, and my father decided we would stop there until morning. The animals were led to water, and we made camp. But before the meal, my father and my mothers gathered by the banks of the Euphrates and poured a libation of wine into the great river. We were not the only ones at the ford. Up and down the banks, traders had stopped to eat and sleep. My brothers wandered and stared at the new faces and strange clothes. "A camel!" Joseph shouted, and our brothers chased after him to get a closer look at the spindly-legged beast. I could not go with them, but I did not regret being left behind. It gave me a chance to go down to the river, which drew me like a storyteller. I stood by the water's edge until the last trace of daylight had drained from the sky, and later, after the evening meal, I returned to savor the smell of the river, which was as heady to me as incense, heavy and dark and utterly different from the sweet, thin aroma of well water. My mother, Leah, would have said I smelled the rotting grasses of the marsh and the mingled presence of so many animals and men. But I recognized the scent of this water the way I knew the perfume of my mother's body. I sat by the river even after the others went to sleep. I dangled my feet in the water until they were wrinkled and soft and whiter than I had ever seen them. In the moonlight, I watched as leaves made their way slowly downstream and out of sight. I was lulled by the slow rush of the water against the shallow banks and was nearly asleep when voices roused me. Turning to look upstream, I saw two shapes moving about in the middle of the river. For a moment, I thought they might be river demons or water beasts come to drag me to a watery grave. I had no idea that people could move through the water like that. I had never seen swimming. But soon, I realized they were merely men. The Egyptians who owned the camel, speaking to one another in their strange, purring language. Though their laughter was quiet, the water carried the sound as though they were whispering directly in my ears. I did not go to my blanket until they had left the water and returned the river to continue his peaceful journey through the night, undisturbed. In the morning, my father and my brothers walked into the river without even pausing, lifting their robes to keep dry. My mothers hung their sandals upon their girdles and giggled about showing so much of their legs. Zilpah hummed a river song as we crossed.